is Friday, June 1st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, the United States imposes tariffs on steel and aluminum from the European Union, Canada, and Mexico. President Donald Trump is expected to receive a personal letter from North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, and two rappers engage in a dispute that's getting a lot of publicity. It's all ahead. States is escalating transatlantic and North American trade tensions by imposing a 25% tariff on steel imports and a 10% tariff on aluminum imports from the European Union, Canada, and Mexico beginning Friday. China's foreign ministry said Friday that all countries should protect the normal trade order when asked about the U.S. decision. President Donald Trump said Thursday that the days of the U.S. being taken advantage of in trade deals are over, in a harshly worded statement responding to Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's criticism of new steel and aluminum tariffs. Trump intensified his criticism of Canada Friday for what he says are the country's highly restrictive trade practices. Jessica Light is assistant professor of economics at American University here in Washington. She tells me that the U.S. is boosting the tariffs on some of its closest allies.
Absolutely. I think a lot of observers are surprised that the first volley in the trade war, so to speak, has targeted allies rather than countries that are viewed as rivals. But regardless of who the target is of tariffs, they're always disruptive to the economy. They're essentially taxes on consumers and businesses using imported inputs and will ultimately prove to be costly and inefficient.
How so? How will they prove to be costly and inefficient?
First of all, concretely, tariffs raise the cost of imports. Of course, that's what they're targeted to do. That means any purchaser of an imported good, whether that's a consumer directly or another business seeking to use that good, has to pay more. That raises the cost of doing business. It makes consumers less willing to purchase and thus slows down our domestic economy. Also, tariffs increase uncertainty for businesses. It makes it hard for them to plan for the future, hard to project investment, to think about expanding, and that type of uncertainty can really put a brake on economic growth.
Well, now, EU Commissioner Cecilia Malmström said that after the tariffs took effect that they were illegal and the EU would initiate a settlement dispute case with the World Trade Organization. I would think this could get very complicated, I guess, bureaucratically in the next few weeks or months.
Absolutely. So the World Trade Organization has procedures in place to prevent these types of ad hoc tariffs. They are lengthy procedures, and that process could be slow and time-consuming. The longer it goes on, the longer businesses, both U.S. and foreign, will readjust their decision-making and conclude that doing business with the United States could be more costly and uncertain than they think.
Well, and meanwhile, two heads of state who seem to be fairly friendly with President Trump, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, as well as French President Emmanuel Macron, expressed their displeasure. Trudeau called the tariffs totally unacceptable, and Macron said that economic nationalism leads to war. That's a rather frightening statement.
Right. So both Trudeau and Macron were referring, I believe, to the history of the Great Depression in the 1930s. Economists and historians believe that a key factor in the intensity of the Depression was protectionist policies that existed at the time, and of course that paved the way for World War II. Now, we may not expect such a drastic scenario to unfold again, but it's worth noting that the consequences of tariffs like this are unpredictable. Countries will face economic and political pressures to retaliate. This can lead to tit-for-tat escalation that can seriously damage both global economic relations as well as the political relations that underlie those ties.
Well, and I've also heard about products here in the U.S., tariffs, there could be penalties against them, say such things as Kentucky bourbon and, Tennessee whiskey or Harley Davidson's made in Wisconsin, that kind of thing, that, you know, American goods, it could be harder to sell those abroad.
Absolutely. So we can expect our trading partners will retaliate with tariffs on American-produced goods. They may well choose goods that are particularly iconic, such as Harley Davidson, or goods that are produced in politically sensitive areas. Of course, that's up to their own strategic choices. But regardless, we can expect that American producers will start to face consequences when they seek to sell abroad. Many analysts believe those consequences could be particularly significant for American farmers, given that farming exports drive a substantial share of U.S. exports.
Jessica Light, Assistant Professor of Economics at American University. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi calls for rule-based order in the Indo-Pacific. Pakistan installs an interim prime minister to oversee new polls. The opposition socialist leader becomes prime minister of Spain, and a 14-year-old wins the Scripps National Spelling Bee here in the U.S. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
In the early 2000s, scientists uncovered an odd-looking, tiny lizard-like fossil in the Dolomites Mountains of northern Italy. An international team of paleontologists then set out to learn about the fossil's identity and origins. A new study published in the journal Nature reveals their findings. It turns out that the 76-millimeter-long fossil dates back 240 to 250 million years and has been identified as an ancient lizard species called Megachirella. The researchers say what they encountered is the oldest lizard fossil ever found. The study also reveals that the Megachirella is 75,000 years older than what were previously thought to be the oldest fossil lizards, leading some in the science community to call this ancient species the mother of all lizards and snakes. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, a year after President Donald Trump announces the withdrawal from the Paris Climate Agreement, other countries stay the course. President Trump will receive a personal letter Friday from North Korean leader Kim Jong-un ahead of preparations for a potential summit later this month between the two men. Trump is expected to receive the letter from a senior North Korean official, Kim Yong-chol, who has traveled to Washington. Kim Yong-chol is the highest-ranking North Korean official to visit the United States in nearly 20 years. The development comes a day after Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said real progress had been made in discussions to revive the potential June 12th summit. Jen Wang is an assistant professor of political science and international relations at Middle Tennessee State University. International Edition's David Byrd asked her what she thinks Kim Jong-un is hoping to gain from the proposed summit.
Probably he will seek three things from President Trump. And number one, which is the most important for Kim, is some sort of assurance from the United States that the regime of North Korea will survive, and also the Kim family, Kim Jong-un, will be able to stay in power. And the second thing is that also tied to the first priority is that the United States will remove the sanctions immediately, and because that helps alleviate the economic conditions in the country, helps feed its people, and also improve the legitimacy of the Kim regime. And the last thing I think that more of a long-term strategy for Kim Jong-un is to seek the normalization of diplomatic relations with the United States and the rest of the world, and because that also helps improve the isolation of the regime and in the long term helps improve the ruling legitimacy of Kim Jong-un in the country.
Pompeo mentioned the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. Now, the Korean Peninsula is not just North Korea, it's also South Korea. Do you think that is a realistic goal coming out of this discussion?
Personally, I do not think that this is a realistic strategy. And because, as you probably know, that the Korean Peninsula, the situation has been there for quite some time. So I do not think that this one meeting, this quick fix, deal or no deal solution will really get away the problem. And also, I think for North Korea, we have to understand that as a small state, it has to have some sort of leverage to be able to negotiate with the United States. And the nuclear program is very good at serving that purpose, is to serve as a deterrence. And so if the regime in North Korea gets rid of the nuclear program, what else does it have? And also, it did not help when the National Security Advisor Bolton mentioned about the Libya model. And so that's not a very promising sign. And also, when we think about the Trump administration, it does not really have a good record in terms of maintaining a policy consistency, and also Trump himself keeping his promises.
What role do you think that China is playing in bringing the two sides together? They are a big trading partner with North Korea. They share a border with North Korea. And they have their own goals in what the administration refers to as the Indo-Pacific region.
On one hand, of course, China shares the goal with America, that is to stop North Korea's nuclear program. But at the same time, China is concerned with American influence in the region, and especially if you look at the current dispute with America in terms of South China Sea and also the tariff war. And so China does not want to see a friendly relationship between North Korea and America. So again, so China, that means China has to play very carefully with this balancing game in this situation.
Jen Wang, Assistant Professor of Political Science and International Relations at Middle Tennessee State University. 1 year ago today, President Donald Trump announced the United States would withdraw from the Paris Climate Agreement. Many U.S. states, cities, and businesses have said they are still in. And no other country has followed Trump's lead. But as the United States steps back from climate action, it remains to be seen whether others will fill the gap. VOA Steve Barragona has more.
Todd Stern was the U.S. chief negotiator in Paris. He says the picture has been mixed since President Donald Trump said the United States was pulling out of the climate accord.
The first most important piece of good news, and it wasn't a foregone conclusion, was that other countries stayed in.
Some countries have announced plans to step up their efforts. Several have pledged an end to gas and diesel vehicles or coal-fired electricity, though not all have set deadlines. And although the U.S. federal government is doing less to fight climate change, states and cities have said they will do more. Virginia, for example, is working to join a 9-state cap-and-trade program that requires power plants to pay for their carbon pollution. Virginia Deputy Commerce Secretary Angela Navarro says many states were already taking action on climate before Trump's announcement.
A lot of this work, I think, would have occurred naturally, but it gave us kind of a galvanizing point.
A coalition of states, cities, and businesses representing more than half of the U.S. economy pledged to meet the nation's Paris commitment. That includes Fortune 500 names like McDonald's, Walmart, and PepsiCo that have set targets to cut their carbon footprint. On the other side of the ledger are the Trump administration's efforts to roll back regulations, says climate policy analyst Kate Larson at the Rhodium Group.
The question is, how will it all pencil out? Are the federal rollbacks and the intention of the federal government to not move forward with some of these climate policies more than enough to tip the balance?
Meanwhile, scientists say the world is falling far short of the Paris goal to keep global warming to less than 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. All countries have to ramp up their efforts. But with the Trump administration stepping back, former U.S. climate negotiator Todd Stern says other countries may be less willing to step up.
You see the United States, the biggest historic emitter, the second biggest emitter now, suddenly saying, you know, never mind. What's the impact of that? Obviously not good.
Negotiators will meet in Poland in December, aiming to finalize the rulebook for how to implement the Paris Climate Agreement. Experts say that will be one of the first indications of how serious countries are about increasing efforts to meet their climate goals, with or without the United States. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Washington.
Once a pristine Thai paradise, the secluded bay made famous by the Leonardo DiCaprio movie The Beach has been exhausted by mass tourism. VOA's Steve Miller reports the iconic film location is closed for now.
After Friday, the daily influx of dozens of boats and thousands of visitors unsuccessfully scrambling for an unspoiled view of Maya Bay's emerald waters and glistening white sand will end. The attraction is being closed for 4 months to give its coral reefs and sea life a chance to recover. Thailand has promoted unfettered tourism for decades, and the onslaught on Maya Bay has only picked up the pace in recent years. Authorities now say they are striving to balance profit and conservation, and the closure will happen every year.
We don't blame anybody. We try to regulate it. In the past, we will make some mistake because we think that money is very important. But now we are trying to change our idea. Thai people change our idea already. We think that money is important also. And visit overseas visitor is very important to our country. But the most important thing is our natural resource that we have to preserve and handle it to the next generation.
An average of 4,000 visitors per day arrive by fishing boats and by speedboats, destroying much of the coral reefs and the sea life in the area. Pramini Jiva and Sanjana Kartik are glad to have made the trip out to Pipile Island on the last day the beach will be open.
Decided to spend 2 days here, and we found out that this was the last day to go, and it all worked out.
So yeah.
Really happy about that. Yeah. Really beautiful.
But it's kind of sad, though, at the same time, to know that they're closing because tourists have spent so much time here and kind of ruined the natural life.
Many Thai marine national parks are closed from mid-May to mid-October during the monsoon season. But because of Maya Bay's popularity, it has never had a break since Hollywood set foot on its sand in 1999 to film The Dark Backpacker Tale, based on a novel by Alex Garland. The government has set a limit of 2,000 tourists a day when the bay reopens, about half the current number. Boats will no longer be allowed to anchor, but must dock on the opposite side of the island. Steve Miller, VOA News.
This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
This is International Edition. A battle between two rap singers is nothing new, but a musical shoving match that has been going on for years has hit new heights, as Top 20 Countdown host Ray McDonald tells VOA's Jim Stevenson.
You used to call me on my cell phone, late night when you need my love. Call me on my cell
phone. You hear about rap battles all the time. Some rapper is always in conflict with another one. However, this week's big news story concerns a rap battle of unusual intensity between Drake and Pusha T. Now, it all started last week when Pusha T released his third solo album, Daytona. And one of the tracks, Infrared, accused Drake of using ghostwriters. And incidentally, this is a charge that others have raised against Drake in the past. Well, less than 24 hours later, Drake fired back with the song Duppy Freestyle, which targeted Pusha T along with his record label boss, Kanye West. This week is when things really started heating up. Pusha T responded with the story of Adidon. The single's artwork features Drake in blackface makeup, while the lyrics accuse Drake of being a deadbeat dad. It alleges he has a secret son by a former adult film star.
Wow.
On May 30th, Drake issued a statement addressing not the lyrics of the song, but the blackface photo. He explained that the photo dated from 2007, when Drake was a young actor. He says he and a fellow actor were working on a project about African-American stereotyping and how hard it was to get good roles as a young African-American actor. The statement began, "I know everyone is enjoying the circus, but I wanted to clarify this image in question." So Drake is trying to put himself above the fray, but in reality, the circus has been going on for nearly two decades. Pusha T used to be in a duo, Clips, and Clips had gotten into a pay dispute around the year 2000 with a rapper named Birdman, who ran the Cash Money label. Cash Money was where Drake became a major rap attraction after Lil Wayne signed him to the label in 2009. So you had these two factions that have been firing back and forth for a long, long time. That wasn't the end of it. Thursday, Pusha T went on a Los Angeles radio station and said Drake's explanation with the blackface photo didn't change his mind at all. He accused Drake of being silent on all black issues, despite having the biggest platform possible. So Pusha T is out for blood. He's really going in on Drake. Mm-hmm. And as you can imagine, social media has been on fire with this conflict this week. And the consensus seems to be that Pusha T is landing more punches than Drake. Mm. So it's going to be interesting to see how Drake responds to this, because obviously Pusha T is far from done.
And as we know, social media can be quite a battleground.
It can indeed.
Maybe more so than the actual back and forth between these two.
Absolutely.
We'll see how it plays out, but we always like to see how the Top 20 Countdown plays out each and every week. Ray McDonald brings it to us on VOA 1, and you can also catch him on Facebook.
At VOA 1 The Hits.
Thanks so much, Ray.
You got it, Jim.
All the energy that you bring to me. My last girl would tear me apart, but she never wanna split a thing with me. But when it comes to you, I think I lie for you. I think I die for you. Do things when you want me to. Like controller, controller.
And that is our show. Please remember to visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us. Have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States welcomes the long overdue release of Joshua Holt and his wife Tamara, who were unjustly imprisoned in Venezuela. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo thanked U.S. Senator Bob Corker, Senator Orrin Hatch, Senator Mike Lee, Representative Mia Love, and other members of Congress and staff who worked on behalf of the Holt family over the past 2 years and helped to make their return to the United States a reality. The Holt's ordeal began in June 2016 when Joshua had traveled to Venezuela to marry Tamara Coleno, whom he had met on an online dating site. About 3 weeks later, Venezuelan police arrested Mr. Holt for allegedly conspiring against the government of President Nicolas Maduro. Police claimed they had uncovered a cache of assault rifles and other weapons among Mr. Holt's possessions. Mrs. Holt was also jailed for being an alleged accomplice. Both Holts denied all the charges. Despite repeated efforts by U.S. government officials, the Venezuelan authorities refused to free the Holts until May 26th, when Senator Corker, the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, met with President Maduro in Caracas and secured their release. U.S. policy toward Venezuela remains unchanged, declared Secretary Pompeo. The United States stands steadfast in support of the Venezuelan people and their efforts to return to democracy. The safety and welfare of U.S. citizens overseas is among the Department of State's highest priorities, said Secretary Pompeo. On behalf of the State Department and the entire United States government, we wish Joshua Holt and his family the best after this difficult period.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage. www.voanews.com/editorials.